Thank you. Our next case is, I hope I pronounced this correctly, Christine Hansen versus Christopher Hansen. The appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument, respondent will have 15 minutes, and then finally appellant will have 15 minutes. So when counsel for the appellant is ready, if you can just tell us who you are in a loud voice, and then you may begin. Thank you.
May it please the court, your honors, I'm Amanda Blumgren, and I am here on behalf of appellant Christopher Hansen. The matter before you relates to post-decree matters, specifically with respect to the court's implementation, enforcement, and clarification of a property settlement arising out of a dissolution of judgment that was heard on the merits at trial. The Hansons were divorced after a fairly short marriage, only about 4 years. And also somewhat notable, this is what I would describe as a later marriage. Both parties at the time of the dissolution were in their early 50s. Because of this, they brought significant property to the marriage, and disposition of that property post-decree is what's at issue in this case. Specifically, there's two separate categories of property of concern. One is my client's retirement accounts and the actual division or allocation of the award relating to those accounts. And separately, Ms. Spratt's investment property and the division of the proceeds or arguably losses attributable to that. I'm going to start addressing the retirement accounts. Specifically, we're only talking about two accounts, a Fidelity account and ACIST Medical, A-C-I-S-T Medical account. With respect to those accounts, it's important to first acknowledge that the law is really well settled with respect to division of property, and that after a judgment and decree is entered and the appeal period is passed, property settlements are final and they may not be substantively modified. Case law has identified that with respect to property settlement, an increase or decrease in a property award would be considered a substantive modification of that award. With respect to these accounts, despite very clear definitions set forth in the conclusions of law, the court awarded one half of the full value of the accounts and chose not to follow the conclusions of law. The conclusions of law with respect to both accounts are quite similar. I'm going to read the definition for the Fidelity Investment account. Specifically, in conclusion of law 9, the court stated, for purposes of this account, the marital portion shall be defined as any and all appreciation and contributions from October 11th, 2014 to April 1st, 2018. That's effectively the period of marriage, the 2014 date being the date of marriage, and that April 1st date being kind of the end of the period that was the closest to the date of valuation that the court determined. For the other account, the only difference in the definition is that terminating date was May or March 31st instead of April 1st. The court and Ms. Spratt have argued that
Ms. Blumberg, can I at that point, can I interrupt please to ask, so am I correct in understanding that conclusion of law 9 is inconsistent with or somehow somewhat incongruous with the relevant finding of fact? I think it's 29, I'm not sure of the number, but there's a finding of fact that that seems inconsistent with paragraph 9 of the conclusions of law. Is that an accurate statement of the problem here?
It could be. I think that there's a way to interpret the conclusions in a consistent manner with the findings. The law allows the court to look at the totality of the circumstances. And so when you look at the fact that my client testified regarding the non-marital characteristic of those accounts, and that stated in the findings, and then the length of the marriage and the age of the parties. Those things do allow a consistent interpretation, but I also think that the court could find.
How would you harmonize them? Could you say that right now?
I would harmonize them by looking at the totality of the facts against that conclusion, and specifically one of the reaches that Miss Spratt's counsel takes is that the court found that there was, she argues that the court found that there was no marital component of that account. That's not true. The court may have omitted specifically defining that. So I think it's open for, it's not perfect, but the law also supports that if this court would find that those two, that the findings and the conclusions are inconsistent with one another, given the fact that the appeal period has passed, the court does need to look to the conclusions. And when you look to the conclusions.
Is there authority for that?
Yes, Your Honor. That is identified in our, in laid out in my pleadings. I'm sorry, I'm missing the case offhand, but that case law is cited and it's fairly well settled that when there is that inconsistency, the court does need to look to the conclusions of law. Also here,
if we don't get to that before your initial argument, perhaps you could identify that case in your rebuttal argument.
I certainly will, Your Honor.
Counsel, what do we do with the district court's specific findings and conclusions that your client failed to prove any the existence of any non-marital portion of his retirement accounts?
Your Honor, that's what we're appealing. The issue is that the court needs to look to the conclusions of law in the judgment and decree. And then the issue is that what we're appealing is the district court's review of the judgment and decree. Effectively, the judgment and decree is the law, at least in part, that guides the court in its interpretation and enforcement.
What evidence did your client present at trial to establish a marital, non-marital portion of those retirement accounts?
Your Honor, my client testified to that fact. And he also, he testified to that, and he effectively that it was his testimony, and the law does, that's the Doering case. The Doering case identifies the fact that that testimony alone can support that position.
Well, and doesn't the district court's finding that he failed to establish a non-marital portion indicate the district court didn't credit his testimony?
I don't believe that. I think when you look at the language, it's not that specific and it's not that clear. I also think that.
Well, I mean, the district court clearly said he's failed to establish any non-marital portion of the retirement accounts. I don't know how it could be much clearer.
I think what the court was looking at there is when you've got a situation where there's a short marriage and there's these circumstances, you've got money coming in at the time of the marriage. And then you've got the question of contributions and appreciation on those contributions. And the court appears to be more specifically focused on the contributions and appreciation. And if you look at the procedural history of the case, what my client did seek review of between the trial order and the amended findings was to add, to have those contributions and appreciations be considered non-marital. And ultimately, Your Honors, at the end of the day, I think that if there's an issue here, it's that Ms. Spratt should have appealed that question back at the time of the judgment and decree. And now we're faced with the fact that we have a very clear dictate in conclusions of law that say what need to be followed and define the marital portion of the judgment and decree.
Why would wife appeal the district court's conclusion that husband failed to prove a non-marital portion? Why didn't husband appeal that conclusion?
There is no conclusion that says
or finding.
Because the conclusions supported his position. The conclusions he did ask for review on having the appreciations and the contributions during the marital period be considered non-marital. He did not need to appeal the conclusion of law that said that defined the marital portion as the window of marriage and appreciations and contributions during that time period. And I think a little bit back to your question about time period during or what evidence did he submit, it's a little remiss in a dissolution matter to not suggest that we're often going back and looking at additional information and evidence in order to do specifically what the court was tasked here with and has authority to do, which is to interpret, clarify, and enforce judgments and decrees. That's exactly what we do when we ask the court to enter qualified domestic relations orders.
Ms. Blumgren, following up on Judge Larkin's question, I'm looking at Judge Connolly's order, C-O-N-L-E-Y, in number five, where it says, the court denied Mr. Hansen's motions for amended findings regarding the Fidelity and ACES retirement accounts because he could not articulate why the court's conclusions in the J&D that he failed to carry his burden at trial was defective. In fact, it was not until July 12, 2019, after both the trial and the order on his motion for amended findings that Mr. Hansen for the first time provided documentation that the retirement counts were established prior to the marriage. Is that true? I mean, I know you're saying he testified to that at trial, but did he not provide documentation until the time period that Judge Connolly indicated in his order?
He did not provide the documentation in order to do the very specific calculation that was necessary to implement the conclusions of law. Also, the paragraph.
Well, then doesn't his failure to provide those documents prevent him from getting the conclusion of the law that he wants?
I don't think so. And the reason is because I think the threshold burden when you've got this length of marriage and you've got these circumstances is fairly low. And the court set forth its conclusion of law, and it's not appropriate to ignore that conclusion at this.
Okay, but here's the problem I have with your argument. You had a trial. At trial, each party has the obligation to present evidence that supports findings and conclusions consistent with their request for relief. I mean, you seem to be saying, well, we have a trial and the judge makes some sort of general findings. And then afterwards, outside of the context of a trial, we'll then submit our documentary evidence to support our position. I don't understand why that evidence wasn't presented at trial to show non-marital portion, an active investment, and the other standards that go into a determination of how you determine marital versus non-marital.
He submitted enough information in order for the court to issue the conclusion of law that it did.
And which conclusion is that, that you're referring to?
The conclusion of law that the marital portion shall be defined as any and all appreciations and contributions from October 11th, 2014 to April 1st, 2018. Now the court is charged with implementing that, no different than when we work with a quadro and needing to do that calculation, and additional evidence was submitted to do so. And it's the implementation of the conclusion of law that my client submitted the additional evidence for.
Are you reading that to sort of be like the district court saying, well, he hasn't proved it yet, but I'm going to give him an opportunity to prove it with regard to this period of time?
No, I think that the district court looked at the totality of the circumstances and the length of this marriage and determined that the marital portion was simply this time period. And
well, could it mean that the district court was saying, well, this would have been the marital portion if he had presented evidence to prove what his contributions were in that period? I mean, I'm having a hard time understanding how we get around the district court saying so clearly that he failed to prove the existence of any non-marital portion, even though the district court defined what a non-marital portion might look like.
But the district court defined the non-marital portion, and they also stated that they included findings about what he testified to. And ultimately, again, and Judge Johnson, I will cite to that case, I think at the end of the day, the conclusions of law control in this case. Unfortunately, we focused primarily on this issue, and we've also got the matter regarding the Cartway property. And I would like to take my last minute or so to address that. The issue with respect to the Cartway property primarily relates to the fact that the second mortgage was not disclosed. There was discussion of this obligation, And now Ms. Sater and her client are trying to attempt to subvert that as some sort of a second mortgage. And my client has submitted evidence that there actually is no obligation on this specific property relating to that second mortgage. And more notably, the court appears to have set that specific obligation and set it to Ms. Hansen when they required her to be responsible for the KTB obligation. So she's trying to double up on those two things, which is problematic and either should be addressed as a review of the, as a modification of the property settlement or reopening the case for fraud. And there you'd be looking at that summary judgment standard that's laid out in my brief. Thank you.
Got it. Thank you, Ms. Blomgren. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Kelly Sater and I represent Christine Ann Spratt, formerly known as Christine Ann Hansen. There are three issues here that appellant asks this court to consider. The first issue has been addressed by the district court four times. The second has been addressed by the district court three times. And the issue of attorney's fees was awarded in part for that reason. The first issue related to the two retirement accounts. Appellant cannot dispute that both the trial court in 2018 and again the April 25th order, the court was clear that the husband failed to meet his burden or prove any non-marital claim in the retirement accounts. The most recent order, which this court is to review, not the original judgment and decree, the time for that appeal has since passed. But this court is reviewing the November 7th, 2019 order, which made even clearer that said, while the trial court's judgment and decree perhaps should not have continued to refer to the dates of the marriage once it found that Mr. Hansen failed to meet his burden of proof, there is no reasonable reading of the order that allows for the conclusion that any portion of Mr. Hansen's retirement accounts were non-marital property.
But isn't that what the conclusion of Law 9 says?
The logical conclusion being then that the accounts were entirely marital and would be divided equally based on the value found at trial, yes. The only reason that this issue is even procedurally viable to be considered here is because husband improperly attempted to relitigate this issue when wife brought a motion seeking enforcement and payment. Quite simply, what has occurred here is that husband failed to provide evidence at trial, failed to follow the court's order to draft and file the necessary qualified domestic relations orders, then consolidated the retirement accounts and manufactured an issue that he claims now requires the court to go back and consider evidence that he failed to produce at trial or at any time in the 9 months after trial leading up to the motion.
Ms. Sater, could you answer the question that I asked Ms. Blomgren earlier, and that is, you know, how do you reconcile finding of fact 29, I believe it is, maybe a different number, and conclusion of Law 9?
Your Honor, I think that they are not inconsistent. I think that the court clearly found that there was no non-marital claim. I think for purposes of instructing the parties on how to put together a qualified domestic relations order. The court was identifying the length of the marriage, but I don't think that the court in any way meant that to be that the retirement accounts should only, that the value of the retirement accounts should only be divided as to that time frame, especially because the court made clear that there was no non-marital claim established. The court reviewed that finding and those potential inconsistencies in its April 25th order, and again concluded that there was no non-marital claim established and that the entire accounts were marital. And then again in November 7th, the court reached the same conclusion. So if there was any discrepancy or uncertainty about how those provisions were consistent, the court multiple times addressed that. And this court is asked to identify whether or not that November 7th order was clearly erroneous. Moreover, as a result of the appellant's direct defiance of the court order, his argument really relies on a hypothetical that if husband had drafted the qualified domestic relations order, then the plan administrator would have had to calculate this marital portion. But in my brief, I explain why this hypothetical fails, but importantly, there's no reason to believe that the result would have been any different than it was in July of 2019. Husband submitted his evidence and information. He argued his interpretation of that marital portion. He had an opportunity to argue to the court that the marital portion should only be between those timeframes. Wife argued that that new evidence was irrelevant and it shouldn't be considered since the final judgment and decree found that the accounts were entirely marital. And the district court, in reviewing that, agreed. Still, husband maintains that the district court abused its discretion by improperly ignoring the evidence submitted by husband or failed to do a proper calculation. But there's no evidence in the record to support that the court ignored the evidence, but rather properly found that the accounts were marital and therefore was entitled to half of the value.
Counsel, I see some congruity between what happened with father's issue or husband's issue and wife's issue in that based on the record before us, I'm not seeing evidence in the trial record establishing this second mortgage that was deducted from the Cartway property. Yet wife is coming back after the trial and post trial submissions offering evidence to attempt to prove the existence of that second mortgage and that it should be deducted from the Cartway property and not treated as a liability against the other business. I mean, frankly, I'm having a hard time understanding why either husband or wife gets to come back after trial and present evidence to establish what should have been proved at trial. Could you address that? How is what husband did, which you're complaining about, any different than what wife is doing when it comes to this purported second mortgage on the Cartway property?
Sure. The difference is that husband had the evidence available to him at the time of trial and failed to present
it. Are you suggesting that wife, that there was a second mortgage close to $100,000 on the Cartway property and wife did not have evidence available to prove that at the time of trial?
No, Your Honor, she did present it.
What did she present?
So it shows specifically, she identifies in her testimony, she discloses the two different mortgages and testifies about them. And she presented two exhibits showing the amount of those two loans at the time.
When you say she presented two exhibits, are those trial exhibits?
Yes, they were trial exhibits, Your Honor.
What are the exhibit numbers for us?
I don't have those immediately available, Your Honor, but I know that in our brief, she identified, and in her affidavit subsequent, identified those two exhibits.
And what are they? What are the exhibits? Her closing cost statement?
They were the amounts that were currently being held on the loans at the time. Obviously, those loans were paid down prior to the house selling.
But what evidence did she present to show that the loan was an encumbrance on the Cartway property?
Two documents, Your Honor. Two separate
documents. And what are those? Could you describe those?
It was a loan statement from the bank, from Premier Bank.
And that loan statement says that there was a mortgage on the, or that the Cartway property was collateral for the loan?
Yes, exactly. Then in her affidavit in April of 2019, she again clearly showed an official Edina Realty title, an ALTA statement, settlement statement, signed and acknowledged, showing that the payoff of the first mortgage loan to Premier Bank totaled $248,395.28, and the payoff of a second mortgage loan to Premier Bank of $95,915, and showed the total encumbrance.
And that she submitted after the trial.
Yes, because that was...
Okay, so if I dig through the trial record, the only thing I'm going to find showing that the second mortgage was an encumbrance on the Cartway property is a loan statement, you're telling me, which will show that it encumbered the Cartway property.
Yes, Your Honor.
And do you cite to that exhibit in your brief?
I do, Your Honor. And Ms. Spratt cited to it in her affidavit that she submitted in April of 2019. And I believe those two loan Premier Bank loan payoffs are cited as index number 117.
Thank you.
She also attached a letter from Premier Bank signed by the president of the Roseville office showing
again, that was after the trial.
Correct. And Your Honor, the court specifically made findings in the judgment and decree saying it was unknown what the total sale amount would be. And so the court understood that those documents and those calculations would have to inevitably be made after
the
trial.
Here's the problem I have. The district court specifically mentioned the construction loan when talking about a liability that would need to be offset against the proceeds of the sale of the Cartway property. And the district court also talked about costs of sale, which are unknown until the property sells. The district court in the judgment and decree made no findings that there was a second mortgage against the Cartway property. Why is that? If evidence was presented at trial that there was this construction loan and the district court found the construction loan existed and that it was an encumbrance against the Cartway property, if evidence was also presented at trial that there was a second mortgage on the Cartway property, which was an encumbrance, why is there no finding regarding that?
I don't know, Your Honor. But I do know that this letter signed by the president of the Roseville office.
And again, I'm just focusing. I understand, but my concern here again is the parties are supposed to try the case at the trial, not in post-trial motions. I'm looking at the evidence in the record that supports the judgment and decree. I mean, because essentially it looks like another district court judge who didn't try the case made an implicit finding that there was a second mortgage against the Cartway property, even though the judge who tried the case and heard the evidence didn't make such a finding. And it appears that the majority of the evidence supporting that post-trial finding is based on evidence that was submitted after the trial. And it's not clear to me the procedural mechanism that allowed your client to submit any evidence other than evidence regarding cost of sale, because cost of sale could not have been known at trial. But existence of mortgages close to $100,000 would certainly have been known at trial.
And again, Your Honor, those were disclosed at trial. Those amounts are in the exhibit. And I believe that the court is relying on those exhibits and the record as a whole, including Ms. Spratt's testimony at trial about those two mortgages. And again, she cites specifically in her affidavit in April the transcript testimony.
But we don't have a transcript of the trial.
There is, Your Honor. And I can refer you to that. Your Honor, I know that transcript was provided to the district court prior to husband's request for reconsideration and review in January of 2019.
What I'm saying, though, is a transcript was not submitted to this court for the purpose of appeal, was it?
Well, again, Your Honor, this court is asked to review the November 7th order, not the original judgment and decree. This, Your Honor, is since the applicable standard here is one of clear abuse of discretion, the district court is accorded broad discretion with respect to the division of property, relying on the record as a whole, relying on the transcripts, relying on the affidavits and all of the exhibits.
And maybe you can enlighten me, I'm just a little confused. Is the construction loan and the second mortgage the same thing?
No, Your Honor.
That's, I didn't think so. You know, I think for me, speaking from only myself, that's a little problematic. Why am I wrong?
Because Your Honor, wife provided documentation, voluminous documentation of the costs and expenses, but also these showed two different documents of two different loan payoff amounts in order to satisfy the encumbrances on the Cartwright property. For point of clarification,
but I mean, in the, you know, you argue, well, you tell me if I'm wrong. You're arguing that the conclusions of law 9DA, when the dissolution of judgment was amended to read both parties will be liable for one half of the promissory construction loan and any equity in the home, whether that equity is positive or negative, should be divided equally between the parties and the parties will share equally in all encumbrances, liabilities, and losses associated with the party. Now, that's not quite true, is it? I mean, the district court stated in its order that it would amend the dissolution judgment to include that language, but that language was never placed into the amended dissolution judgment. Am I right about that, Ms. Sater?
Your Honor, my understanding is that was made part of the judgment and decree, that both parties would share in those encumbrances and any costs or losses on the property.
Is it fair to say that the appendix to the amended dissolution judgment only listed the construction loan and not the mortgage?
It may have, Your Honor. I don't have it in front of me, but I believe it also included encumbrances. And Your Honor, the other encumbrance against the property was first referred to as a second mortgage by husband in his July 2nd, 2019 order, used that exact language. And so the judgment and decree wouldn't have had that specific language in it, but I believe that that's what the court intended, was that any encumbrances or losses on the property would be shared by both parties. Thank you, Your Honor, for all of the above reasons and based on the standard of review here, we're asking that you affirm the district court's decision. Thank you.
Ms. Blomgren, you'll have the last word, please.
Thank you, Your Honors. I would like to focus a little bit on the Cartway property, but also make sure I have an opportunity to answer Judge Johnson's specific question. And Judge Larkin, you asked some questions regarding the reference to this second mortgage or obligation in at trial or in the judgment and decree. I think that that's very critical to this analysis and also goes to Judge Conley's uncomfortableness with what's happened here. If you take a look at the findings of fact specifically address the evidence that Ms. Sater is referring to. And they talk about the court talks about a $95,000 loan and actually assigns that obligation to Ms. Spratt's other business, and then follows through in the conclusions of law and states that she's obligated to bear the burden of that. So that's my client's critical concern here, and where the fraud comes into this. It appears that what's happened is that due to just kind of references in the air and perhaps imprecise language by family court professionals instead of real estate attorneys using the term mortgage, when in fact there's never been a presentation of this obligation as being secured by, as being actually secured by the property. And that's quite concerning. It doesn't appear that it was ever an actual obligation on the property, and Ms. Spratt is now attempting to subvert it into this division of the real estate proceeds.
Counsel, given some of the documents that were submitted after trial, is it fair to say that it appears that this second mortgage, actually that loan, was secured by two other properties other than the Cartway property? So if there is an encumbrance related to that loan, it's as to two properties that aren't before us. Is that what your documents show?
Yes, Your Honor, I think so. I mean, at this point, again, I'm not a title examiner. I did submit evidence that shows pursuant to a tract search, it does not appear that this loan is securing that property. I fully expect that Ms. Spratt may have had some sort of a relationship with her bank whereby they wanted a payoff of this obligation. And perhaps a payoff at the time of these proceeds. But when we're looking at the terms of the judgment and decree, I don't think that it's my client's obligation to bear the burden of that.
Counsel, could you tell me, to the best of your recollection, what evidence did wife present at trial to establish that there was a second mortgage on the Cartway property? I mean, I'm being told that there's an exhibit that shows a bank statement indicating that this loan is an encumbrance on the Cartway property. Is that your recollection?
I didn't get that impression from the briefs.
I was not counsel at trial. But what I can share with you is that if you look at the amended judgment and decree, when you look under the findings that address KTB Homes, There is a citation in the record in the footnotes to exhibits that were supposedly referencing that loan, and they appear to assign it to that KTB Homes obligation and not they appear to assign it to the other business entity and not the one that owned this property. Unfortunately, I was not at trial to provide that in detail. My brief does cite to Ms. Spratt's reference to those things. I do want to just make sure that I have an opportunity to complete things by referencing Judge Johnson's question about citation to the court's requirement if there is inconsistency to rely on the conclusions, because I do think that that's critical to the court's analysis of both of these issues. For just reference to the brief, Your Honors, that is on page 25, and specifically the case that we're speaking of is the Daly versus Shermack case, which is 709 Northwest 2D 626. A quote from that case that states that parties to the litigation and other interested persons in the courts ought to be able to rely on a final judgment, which incorporates conclusions of law as binding, without having to look back at the findings of fact to determine whether or not they are consistent with the judgment. Further, the Dyseth case states that if a ruling is wrong, once the time to appeal has expired, that ruling's final. Your Honors, thank you for your time today, and my client is seeking remand of this case. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Blumgren. Thank you very much, Ms. Sater. Please stay safe.